June 28th, 1981, Tilden Township, Michigan. After a night of drinking at a local club, 48-year-old Helen Diamond and her husband Roy get into an argument in the parking lot. Roy drives home without his wife, and Helen decides to walk from the club to her son's house in order to spend the night. However, Helen never arrives and vanishes without a trace. The case would be hampered by a faulty police investigation, contradictory stories from eyewitnesses, and the spread of misinformation. But in spite of her family's best efforts to obtain answers, Helen Diamond is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest mini-sode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we're going to be featuring a very special story this week, the 1981 disappearance of Helen Diamond. This case is actually a request from a listener named Crystal, who is friends with one of Helen's relatives, and I have actually consulted with the victim's family to put this mini-sode together. Two of Helen's granddaughters, Holly Letson and April Lohr, were just toddlers at the time she disappeared, but they've worked tirelessly throughout the last decade to keep her case in the spotlight. They've combed through all the original police reports and newspaper articles and posted them on their Facebook page, The Disappearance of Helen Diamond, which is the source of most of the information you'll hear on this podcast. Just this past summer, Helen's story caught the attention of Dateline, who featured it in the Cold Case Spotlight section of their website, and it has recently gotten attention in other media outlets, such as the Upper Peninsula's ABC 10 news program. This is a very frustrating case, as it's obvious the police did a poor job at investigating Helen's disappearance by spreading inaccurate information and not looking into promising leads. Because of the constant misinformation, it's tough to discern what might have actually happened on the night Helen went missing. But I'm going to attempt to analyze this mystery as best I can on this mini-sode, and at the very least, give it some much-needed exposure. But before we get started, just a brief reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which alternates between our regular full-length episodes and 15 to 20-minute mini-sodes like this one. We deliver either a new full-length episode or a new mini-sode every Wednesday. We're currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or a review at any of these sites, as that will help us garner more exposure. The Trail Went Cold has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who's feeling generous and wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it and will definitely give you a shout-out on a future episode. We also received some new donations from a pair of listeners named Matthew and Megan, so thank you very much, guys. So with that out of the way, let us now examine the unsolved disappearance of Helen Diamond. Our story begins in 1981 in the small community of National Mine, which is located in Tilden Township, Michigan. Our central figure is 48-year-old Helen Diamond, who lives there with her husband Roy. They have been married for 30 years at this point and have four grown children. On Saturday, June 27th, Helen and Roy spent the day at the annual township picnic before attending a party at a private members-only club called the Tilden Township Club. Even though the couple were not members, they went as guests of their daughter Betsy and her husband Terry Lohr, who happened to be Holly and April's parents. At around midnight, Betsy and Terry decided to go elsewhere for something to eat, but Helen and Roy chose to stay at the club. Sometime later, Roy was ready to leave, but since he and Helen had both gotten pretty drunk, they were offered a ride home. Roy declined the offer and walked out into the parking lot with his wife. However, Helen wanted to stay longer, and it was here that the couple got into a heated argument, which ended with Roy telling Helen that she could walk home. Roy then climbed into his car and drove away, leaving his wife behind. Helen angrily went back into the club to complain that her husband had stranded her. She tried ordering another drink, but the bartender cut her off, so Helen said she planned to walk over to her son Roy Jr.'s house, which was about a mile away, and spend the night there. After turning down an offer for a ride, Helen left the club and headed in the direction of her son's house. But this would be the last time anyone ever saw her. She never arrived, and no one heard from Helen again. It actually wasn't unusual for Helen to spend the night at Roy Jr.'s house if she had gotten into a fight with her husband, but she always returned home the following day. But this did not happen here, and no one had any idea where she was. There was at least one witness who saw Helen walking down the road that night. Another witness claimed they saw someone walking that route, but could not positively identify the person as Helen, and wasn't even sure if they were male or female. It should have only taken Helen approximately 13 minutes to walk from the club to Roy Jr.'s place, but something clearly happened to her during this brief time period. Anyway, Helen was reported missing, but as you'll often find in a lot of unsolved missing persons cases from this time period, the police told her family that she likely took off on her own and that there wasn't anything they could do until she was gone for at least 24 hours. Of course, Helen's family did not believe she just ran off and really wanted them to waive the 24-hour rule because a large storm was heading for the area. She was finally reported missing on June 30th, and an article ran in the local paper, The Mining Journal, but right from the outset, this investigation would be hampered by misinformation. For starters, one of the biggest issues was trying to nail down the exact time Helen left the club. Some of the patrons said she left it around 2 a.m., but others said it was between 3 and 4 a.m. But there was probably a reason for this big discrepancy. Technically, most of the establishments in the area weren't allowed to serve alcohol after 2 a.m., but that wouldn't have applied to the Tilden Township Club, since it was a private club. However, some people wouldn't have known that. It's most likely that Helen left sometime after 3 a.m., but in order to prevent the club from getting into potential trouble, a couple of the witnesses probably decided to lie and say Helen left at 2 a.m. Unfortunately, this muddied the investigation and created a lot of needless confusion. But the police and the Mining Journal did a lot to create confusion on their own. There were some notable errors in the original police report, as Helen's eye color was listed as brown instead of blue, and the color of the jacket she wore was wrong, which caused a major issue later on. This inaccurate information would make its way into the Mining Journal, and in spite of the Diamond family's repeated efforts to get them to correct it, these errors would be republished in numerous articles. Roy Diamond finally had to pay money out of his own pocket to place his own ad in the paper, which actually contained the correct info. And this didn't happen until nearly 2 whole months after Helen originally went missing. Of course, given that Helen and Roy had been fighting shortly before she went missing, the police did look at him as a possible suspect. However, Roy passed a polygraph test, and everyone believed he was genuinely distraught by his wife's disappearance, so he was ultimately ruled out. On August 25th, a purple nylon windbreaker was found on a footpath 75 feet off Marquette County Road 476 near the Schweitzer Reservoir, nearly 5 miles away from where Helen was last seen. This matched the description of the jacket she was wearing on the night she disappeared. When her family saw it, they were pretty certain it belonged to Helen because it had the same distinct buttons and was missing a pull string just like Helen's windbreaker was. But in spite of this, the police did not believe the jacket was Helen's because she had been missing nearly 2 months at that point, and the windbreaker did not look like it had been exposed to the elements that long. I guess it never occurred to them that the jacket could have been planted there long after the fact. The issue was that the Mining Journal repeatedly published that the color of Helen's jacket was maroon. It was only a week after Roy placed an ad listing the correct color of her jacket as purple that the windbreaker suddenly turned up on the footpath. On the surface, it really seemed like someone decided to get rid of it once the purple jacket got mentioned in the paper. A few other items were found near the windbreaker, including a stone with red substance on it, and some tube stockings which resembled the type of stockings Helen was known to wear. 1 year after Helen's disappearance, another witness reported that right after she went missing, he saw some tire tracks in a clearing near the Tilden Township Club, which he found unusual since this was an area where cars never usually drove. But since he was never interviewed by police, this area was not searched until a year after the fact. A woman's penny loafer was found, but unfortunately, Helen's family never even learned about this until they looked at the original incident reports 2 decades later. By this point, the shoe was probably long gone from evidence. No one knows if it might have belonged to Helen, though her family does remember that she probably was wearing moccasins that night. There would be more confusion in the investigation when a witness claimed that Helen stopped off at a party shortly after leaving the club. This party took place at a house owned by a man named James Treloar, and was located on Helen's route to Roy Jr.'s place. About a year after Helen's disappearance, James's brother, Roger Treloar, approached Helen's son-in-law, Terry Lohr, in a bar and told him that he chatted with Helen in the living room for a few minutes. She apparently said something about going to a camp before she left. If these details seem pretty fuzzy, that's because it's unclear if the police formally interviewed Roger. In their original notes, Roger is referred to as mentally retarded, so they might not have taken him seriously. James Treloar was interviewed, and he did confirm that a party took place at his house that night, but he denied seeing Helen. He even agreed to take a polygraph test and passed. However, it must be noted that James was heavily intoxicated, and he and most of the guests were upstairs with loud music playing, so it is possible that Helen could have stopped by without him knowing it. It's worth noting that Roger apparently had a tendency to spout dumb things when he was drinking, and he might have decided to fabricate the story if he was mad at his brother and wanted to get him into trouble. So you should probably take everything he said with a grain of salt. But it's just one more frustrating element to this case that probably wasn't investigated as thoroughly as it should have been. And here's yet another example. National Mine happens to be the home of the Tilden Mine, so as you might have guessed, there are a lot of mine pits in the area. So if someone killed Helen, there would have been plenty of places to hide her body. Apparently, a local resident heard rumors that Helen had been hit by a car and that her body was dumped in a mine pit, so he decided to start searching some of them. He didn't find anything, but decided to share his info with the authorities, but if you look at the original report, they mentioned that he sounded intoxicated and was a known alcoholic, so I'm not sure if they took him seriously either. These mine pits often get filled with rain and groundwater, and law enforcement never went to the trouble of draining them to perform a search. Since Terry Lohr was an employee of the Upper Peninsula Power Company, he actually made arrangements for them to work together with Tilden Mine to drain one particular mine pit, but the police put a stop to it. And the reason? Well, apparently, a resident complained that the ducks in the area would be affected if this draining operation caused the water levels to be lowered. Because obviously, those poor ducks should take priority over a missing persons case. On October 30th, 1981, a 51-year-old woman named Barbara Okeson was murdered in her mobile home when she was beaten and stabbed multiple times. This also took place in Tilden Township, only a few miles away from where Helen was last seen, and the victim's purse was found in a small pond off County Road 476. So one couldn't help but wonder if the cases were connected. There was a suspect in Okeson's murder, who has never been publicly named, but he died in December of that year after being struck by a vehicle. Yet it is possible that the suspect might not have even been the real killer. A hair sample was found in Okeson's hand, and it did not match this person. His handprint also did not match a palm print found on the murder weapon. However, this is not the only violent crime committed against a female victim during this time period. There was also a sexual assault of an elderly woman from Ishpeming who was raped in her apartment in April of 1981. A woman from the area was also attacked in her home just 2 weeks after Helen disappeared before she managed to scare him off. And an attempted sexual assault of a 68-year-old woman took place at a house located on Helen's route in May of 1983. Since this is a small community which normally isn't known for violent crime, there's been speculation that Helen's disappearance, Barbara Okeson's murder, and all these sexual assaults might be connected in some way. In 1988, Betsy Lohr received a phone call from an acquaintance who said he believed his mother's boyfriend might have struck Helen with his vehicle while driving drunk and buried her body on a farm belonging to one of his friends. He signed a sworn affidavit about this, but even though a search was conducted of this farm and nothing was found, it doesn't sound like the police did a very thorough job of following up on this lead. The boyfriend who allegedly struck Helen was already deceased, and the person who owned the farm had gone senile by this point and was unable to provide any information. There is some skepticism about this man's story, as he waited over 6 years to come forward, and apparently, the details in his affidavit do not match the details he provided during his phone call to Betsy. So much like all the other leads in this case, this one pretty much hit a dead end. Even though Helen's family has spent the last several decades doing everything in their power to keep her case in the spotlight, there haven't been any more major developments to lead them closer to the truth. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Yes, sadly, this is not the first missing persons case I've covered on this podcast in which the police botched the investigation by assuming the victim ran away, and it probably won't be the last. This attitude was a lot more prevalent during the 1970s and early 1980s, as police would often just leap directly to the runaway theory even when there was no evidence to support this. It's true that Helen had gotten into a fight with her husband right before she disappeared, but people get into fights with their spouses all the time without just taking off. Even if she was angry with Roy, why break off all contact with your children? Not to mention that Helen didn't drive, had very little money on her, and has never touched her bank account. I'm not saying that people never disappear voluntarily, but when law enforcement develops tunnel vision and ignores potentially interesting leads, then that's very problematic. Thankfully, the internet and the prevalence of social media means this attitude is not as common today, and I'm sure Helen's family would have been able to get her disappearance a great deal more publicity if they'd had all these resources at their disposal back in 1981. Unfortunately, it seems pretty likely that something bad happened to Helen during her walk to her son's house. One possible theory is that Helen could have accidentally fallen into one of those mine pits, but by the sounds of things, she was not the type of person who would leave the road and wander into the woods in the middle of the night. And even though she had been drinking heavily, none of the witnesses at the club felt that Helen was so intoxicated that she was incapable of making a short walk on her own. It's also possible that someone could have noticed Helen on the road and offered her a ride, only to do her harm when she climbed into the vehicle. But given that it was only a 13-minute walk to Roy Jr.'s place, it seems unlikely she would have accepted a ride from a stranger. So the two most plausible theories are that Helen was either accidentally hit by a vehicle, or someone abducted and murdered her. Unfortunately, the police investigation was so poor that it's really tough to discern what might have happened. We have a signed affidavit from a witness who believes Helen was hit and killed by a drunk driver, but the police made little effort to follow up on this, and if they did, they did such a lousy job at keeping a record of it that no one knows if they found anything to support or disprove this story. We have Helen's son-in-law actually going to the trouble of draining a mine to search for her body until the police decided to put a stop to it. And then there's the issue of being unable to get the basic information about her disappearance correct, and the refusal to believe that the purple jacket found on the footpath actually belonged to Helen. I really don't think it's a coincidence that the jacket was discovered such a short time after the paper finally published the correct info about its color. You could easily assume that the person responsible for Helen's disappearance was keeping the jacket as a memento, but panicked and got rid of it once the paper mentioned that it was purple. However, another interesting possibility is that someone with no involvement in the disappearance simply found the jacket somewhere. Or maybe Helen left it behind at the club and someone else took it home with them. When this person saw an ad which tied this purple windbreaker they had with an unsolved missing persons case, they panicked and decided to dump the jacket at a random location. Even if they were completely innocent, they might have been very paranoid about possessing a potentially incriminating piece of evidence, which is why they never came forward. But if Helen's death wasn't an accident and she was a victim of foul play, then who could have been responsible? Well, no one has ever uncovered a really strong suspect, but I would not be surprised if there was a connection between Helen's disappearance and the murder of Barbara Okeson, or the various sexual assaults which took place during this time period. Like I mentioned earlier, there was a suspect in the Barbara Okeson murder, but he was killed in an accident, and after that, the investigation just ground to a halt. Unfortunately, if police believed the suspect was Okeson's killer, they might have also thought he murdered Helen. And since he was dead and there was nothing else they could do, this would be a convenient way to close both the cases. Which would be all well and good if there was any definitive proof this guy was responsible, but some of the physical evidence in the Okeson murder points away from him. If this person was innocent all along, then someone else has gotten away with two unsolved murders. So in the end, the disappearance of Helen Diamond is just one of those cases where there's very little hard evidence to work with, and it will probably be difficult to solve after all these years. But thankfully, Helen has a very devoted family who will continue to fight to ensure she receives justice, and I'm sure they will not stop until this case is solved. Unfortunately, Roy Diamond has since passed away, but Helen has plenty of children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren to keep her memory alive. I would encourage you to visit the Facebook page, The Disappearance of Helen Diamond, and get in touch with them if you have any information. Or you can contact the Michigan State Police at 906-475-9922. That's 906-475-9922. I would like to thank Holly Letson and April Lohr for consulting me on this episode and making sure all the information was accurate. And of course, I want to thank them for working hard to keep their grandmother's case alive. If you just have your own theory about what happened to Helen Diamond, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. I want to thank all my loyal listeners and supporters out there, especially those from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thank you to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who is responsible for composing all of our eerie music tracks. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website. So if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for what will be a very special Christmas episode of The Trail Went Cold.